Welcome to the Gastric Health Show, where we help you achieve the happiest and healthiest version of yourself by motivating you to eat, move, sleep, and think better. Hello, Gastric Health Show. This is Dawn Boxall, and we are back for our next episode and to talk about a very popular topic that I get questions about frequently, and really a different kind of area to think about that a lot of people maybe haven't even considered as a driver of why they're having this problem. So, first and foremost, these podcasts are not intended for medical advice. They are for educational purposes only. So please check with your doctor or healthcare provider about the strategies that we talk about on our podcasts so that you are getting the help that you need. We would love for you to share these podcasts if you find them helpful or relevant to maybe conversations you've had with other weight loss surgery patients or, you know, just other topics that have been brought up in some of those secret and closed groups that you're a part of. So we would be grateful if you shared our podcasts for any of your friends in the other groups. If you are new to us, we would love for you to hang out with us in our closed Facebook group, the Gastric Health Club. So feel free to join us there. And we have lots of conversations and topics. I share things. People ask questions. And it's just a great community, a place that people can, you know, get valuable solutions to their problems. So, and also to stay motivated. Sometimes, you know, life hits and you need somebody to kind of kick you in the butt, and that's a good place to get that and get you back on doing the things you know you need to be doing. So, anyway, let's talk about this topic, a surprising cause of heartburn after weight loss surgery. So this is definitely something that heartburn is such a big topic. And I will say, even at the center where I work, this is an issue, even with the surgeons that they deal with frequently, that they're, you know, struggling to kind of manage sometimes, that they really aren't, they don't have enough available solutions. So to me, I'm all about functional medicine and all about getting to the root cause of why and not just putting a Band-Aid of a pill on it. And that's kind of where I kind of dig. I dig into the research. I dig when I'm with my patients, I'm always saying, okay, yes, you have heartburn, but why do you have heartburn? What is the driver? What's causing this? And there are many things that can be causes of heartburn. So there are many things that we have heartburn. The reason why we have heartburn are self-inflicted. So, you know, maybe we're just making a bunch of poor food choices. We're, you know, super stressed. We're not taking care of our overall health and making it a priority. So we're just kind of, you know, feeding this thing and we're eating too late. We're, you know, we're just doing things that, you know, normal life takes us off on and doing. So regardless, this is just another thing to think about. If you are struggling with heartburn and you really are struggling with finding a permanent solution to treating it and maybe getting rid of it, I want you to consider this as a cause. And if you correct this, then you may not have any issues with heartburn. So it is tricky with weight loss surgery because of what the surgery does. So it does kind of create that environment for a lot of digestion problems. So sometimes you are going to have to take some things forever for life. Supplements preferably, because they are going to not have the side effects. So instead of long-term use of PPIs for heartburn, which is commonly prescribed by most surgeons or family doctors and GI docs, they really kind of overprescribe these and, you know, don't take into consideration the consequences, the long-term consequences of being on these for years and years and decades, which I've had many patients have that as an issue. They come in on PPIs they've been on them for a decade, and they don't know any different. They don't know any better. They don't know that that's a bad thing. So I think, you know, you take in charge of your health and you say, hey, okay, I get it, Mr. Surgeon, you want me to take these right after surgery to kind of help with the healing process and, you know, all that. Totally get it. But okay, I don't want to stay on this forever. So let's get me off. What do you got? What can I do instead? So that you're not trapped on them. So anyway, so you have to look at the big picture. Okay, why do I have heartburn? Is it things that I'm causing that I could clean up and fix? Could I work on my stress? Could I work on cleaning up my diet? Could I work on the timing of when I eat and just, you know, making better choices? That could be one thing. But another thing you can hang your hat on is your ability to really digest foods well and how that messes things up downstream in your small intestines. So that's kind of what we're talking about today. We are talking about small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. So that is a common thing that occurs after weight loss surgery. Going into surgery, research does kind of tell us that about 15% of obese people in general going into weight loss surgery have small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. And then after surgery, they find that it does increase from 15% to about 40%. So this is a big problem in my book. 40% is pretty high. And there was actually two studies. One was 40%, one was 41%. So 40% is pretty spot on, I think, for most weight loss surgery patients. So, you know, it's not 100% of you. So this is not going to be the driver of your heartburn for some of you. But for some, for others, it is. This is going to be the cause of why you're having uncontrollable heartburn, or why you can't get off of PPIs, or why you can't taking some of these H2 blockers or Tums or other antacids. This could be why, because you got to fix this first. So what is SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth? It is really just an overgrowth of bacteria in the small intestines. The majority of our bacteria should be in our colon. And as it migrates upstream to our small intestines is when it can create some problems. And with weight loss surgery, we're kind of setting the environment for that, because with the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, you have a hole. You don't have this flap that slowly releases food into the small intestines. So food, whole food, undigested, is getting dumped into your intestines. So that in and of itself is kind of creating that breeding ground for bacteria to have food to kind of ferment and feed off of. So that's why digestion, working on that piece, is so important after weight loss surgery, and kind of throwing digestive enzymes and throwing probiotics at it, so you have all the raw materials that you need to digest the food, so bacteria isn't going to sit and forage on it. So that, you know, it all kind of migrates in that small intestines, where we shouldn't have tons of bacteria. We have some, but that's not where the majority of our bacteria should reside. That should be lower in the colon. So what are some symptoms of SIBO? So SIBO, some pretty strong ones are abdominal bloating or distension. So if somebody tells me by the end of the day their belly is distended compared to at the beginning of the day, where it's maybe maybe not flat, but flatter. And then by the end of the day, it's kind of more rounded or distended. That's a pretty big red flag for me. That SIBO could be a problem. Also, if you're having issues with constipation and diarrhea, and usually they'll say I have both. So I'll be constipated. I won't have a bowel movement for several days, and then bam, I'll have diarrhea. So they kind of go back and forth. So it's kind of some evidence that hey, there could be a bacterial overgrowth in there. Then another one is you're having a lot of abdominal discomfort or pain, or, you know, when you eat, you know, hours 1, 2, and 3 after you eat, you're really kind of not feeling so fabulous. Your stomach maybe isn't horribly in pain, but it's just not, it doesn't feel good. It's uncomfortable. And then once those few hours pass, you're better. So that could also be a sign. And then, of course, the heartburn. So if you're having constant heartburn and reflux and or just maybe some irritation, you can even think of it as you're having sinus problems, allergy problems. Those are all signs of reflux and heartburn. So now, bam, all of a sudden you started having all these allergic signs and symptoms that started occurring that you've never had before in your life. It may not be allergies at all. It really could just be reflux and heartburn, that, you know, that acid coming back up and it's into your, you know, your sinuses and creating infections, and you're getting that irritation and everything in there. And then another one is excessive gas or belching. So those are all very common symptoms of SIBO. So the gas can be sometimes embarrassing gas. It's foul smelling, and it's not something that you're proud of. So that is something that would be a red flag, because that bacteria is just fermenting all of that food, that undigested food, and just creating all these gases that make you uncomfortable and create the embarrassing gas for you. So why would you get SIBO? So let's talk about maybe the next kind of step. So we're all about the root cause. So maybe you're having these symptoms, but you're like, okay, why do I have SIBO then? What has caused me to have SIBO? So I'm going to go through. There's a ton of causes, and weight loss surgery is one of them. And just having bariatric surgery puts you at higher risk for SIBO. But there's also several other causes. So I'm going to go over those as well. So one of them is low stomach acid, or you're just continuously on a PPI. Shutting off that acid is really getting that perfect environment in your small intestines to be a breeding ground for bad bacteria and to create all those, you know, lots of gas and belching and belly distension and bloating and constipation, diarrhea, all those symptoms. Those PPIs are kind of setting that environment up or making a pretty strong case of really that being the driver. Also, pancreatic insufficiency. So some people don't produce enough enzymes that get squirted out from your pancreas. And our pancreas kind of hooks into our small intestines, and it gets dumped in there when we start smelling food and tasting food and just thinking about food. That all starts that process with our body producing everything it needs to digest foods. So some people don't produce enough of it. And that's where, when it gets in the small intestines and there isn't enough enzymes to break down food, that's when you are setting up the environment for SIBO to occur. And so that's where, you know, digestive enzymes really truly do help the most. Another one is decreased motility. So you can think of different disease stages that or disease states that can be a cause of slow motility. So that would be diabetes or hypothyroid. If you have those, the motor complexes are not maybe moving great. You have slow movement in your intestines, in your colon, for getting food out. So that's where, you know, the constipation is a bigger deal. because the motility is slower. Also, bowel obstructions, which, you know, any weight loss surgery patient is at risk for bowel obstructions. That is a risk factor. So, but that in general, really bowel obstructions is just kind of things that are really impacted and backed up, and then things can't move and gets kind of kinked and twisted, and the bowel is really incapable of moving the stool through because it's kind of changed the whole dynamic of your bowel. So bowel obstructions would put you at risk. Even gastroparesis, so that is when your stomach is not moving, it won't empty correctly, and you just, things just, you know, you have vomiting and things like that. So that kind of sets you up for SIBO. Or if you have a gallbladder or bile dysfunction, so if you're having issues with your gallbladder, or maybe you don't even have a gallbladder anymore. That's a very common thing to lose after weight loss surgery. And many patients come into surgery without a gallbladder. So those are things that really, you know, you're not going to have that bile, and that bile is antimicrobial, so it helps to kill off the bacteria. And if you don't have enough of it, it's, bile is our fat emulsifier, and it's, so it's not going to break down fats. And so it just really is creating that environment for SIBO. Multiple courses of antibiotics. So if you have been on rounds and rounds, you, 3 or 4 times a year, you're on an antibiotic, you are setting yourself up for SIBO. Another one also is heavy alcohol use. Think of those as sugars to fuel those bacteria. So once you start consuming consistent intake of alcohol, you are setting yourself up for SIBO. A diet rich in sugar and simple carbohydrates or refined carbohydrates, those crackers and pretzels and breads and grains and all those that are all in boxes and bags and containers that, you know, the food industry labels to us as healthy and high in fiber and anything else they can think of that convince us to start consuming those regularly, then guess what? You are feeding those bacteria where... that you don't want to feed. You're getting the bacteria to overgrow because it's just constant fuel for it. Also, chronic stress is another one. So if you are consistently stressed and you're not very good at managing it, you might want to think about what you're setting yourself up for with SIBO. Also, another thing that you can think about is excess estrogen. Now, I've talked about hormones and specifically estrogen all on its own on a podcast. So listen to those if you haven't. But this is also pretty cool, I think, to kind of show you the connection of just when those hormones get out of balance, how it can really set you up for this bacterial overgrowth as well. So excess estrogen inhibits the excretion of bile salts. So we talked about those. Those are your fat emulsifiers, but they're also antimicrobial. And those bile salts are excreted from the liver into the intestines. And because of them being antimicrobial, that's where they'll kill those, bad bacteria or not let things get overgrown. They're continuously keeping that environment in check. And those bile salts are important for that. But estrogen also delays gastric emptying and motility. So we talked about that slow motility and how things were moving through too slow. That can also be a cause. Your hormones are the reason why you have SIBO. So if your hormones are all jacked up, guess what? You might have SIBO as well. And that's why you're having heartburn. It's causing all these crazy side effects. So another, which I already said, is a surgical bowel resection or bariatric surgery. Those are definites for higher risk for getting SIBO. Any time that you've had to have those, you're more than likely to get SIBO, or it's a risk factor. And then also something like food poisoning. So if you've ever had food poisoning, guess what? that is something that you can set yourself up for SIBO and cause continuous problems. Then also nerve damage that affects the GI tract. Diabetes is one that comes to mind that can be one that can really damage those nerves that deal with your intestines, the motility and everything. And then drugs like opiates. So if you are on any opiate drugs, that slows all of the motor complexes down and you aren't having adequate bowel movement or it's harder to go. And guess what? Sets you up for SIBO. So that's one thing for sure, that if you are on those or you aren't able to get off of them, then you want to consider what the risks that you're setting yourself up for with SIBO. So make sure that you are considering that when you're making those choices with those medications, that, you know, maybe I can find a different one that would not impact my intestines so directly and cause me other side effects that I'm going to have to work really hard to get corrected. When it comes to SIBO, you know, this is something that you get a test from, or you go with your doctor and they just treat you. So it depends on the practitioner. Some practitioners really require the breath test. There is a breath test you can do that's probably the cheapest and most widely used, but it's not the gold standard. The gold standard is really a jejunal aspirate, where they're actually taking samples. So out of your intestines. So, but that's just not typically used. So breath test is used most widely, but there are flaws in the test, and not everybody that really does have all the symptoms for SIBO will test positive. So they'll get a false negative. So some docs kind of prefer to just, if you have all the symptoms and you kind of have these causes, you have several of these risk factors that would put you high on the list of having SIBO, they'll just treat you regardless. So I think you just need to have that conversation with your doctor and say, hey, I've been researching and I've been having these symptoms, and this is kind of something that came up that I really am questioning if I don't have. So that would give them, you know, the ability to kind of take over and treat you regardless. Some things to understand about testing: when they do a breath test, usually if you're one that is having a lot more diarrhea, you're on those breath tests, you're going to show that you have more hydrogen. And then if you are more with the constipation, you could be more dominant in the methane. So those gases is what they're testing. They usually test it with glucose or lactulose. That's usually the test fuel source, if you want to say, that allows them to even test the gases that's been being produced from these bacteria. So that constipation, if you're having constipation and diarrhea, you can be dominant in methane. So it's not always 100% cut and dry. So keep that in mind. And that kind of explains why some doctors just go ahead and treat you for it and don't even worry about the breath test. So what do you do if you do think that you have SIBO? So you've heard all these risk factors of, you know, the people who are at higher risk to, you know, get SIBO, and you have a lot of the symptoms, then what do you do? So the first thing I would recommend is talk with your doctor, your surgeon, your bariatric team, or get a referral to a gastroenterologist or a GI doc to get that diagnosis or get somebody that will treat you. This is not really something that you can DIY this. There are antimicrobial herbs that you can do. There are things that you can do that are available and that you wouldn't, you know, have to use a prescription. So you would need to get with a practitioner that can help you with that and kind of take you through that process so that you're actually treating it correctly. So usually what happens is most practitioners are going to put you on an antibiotic called rifaximin or Xifaxan, is an alternate name that it's used as. That's the most common one. Unfortunately, this is a medication that's super expensive. It is an antibiotic, but it works. It doesn't work systemically. It doesn't kill all the bacteria throughout your body. It is a very cool antibiotic. So it really does just work in this area. It really just does work in your intestines and colon and really does a great job. So it is one that you shouldn't be afraid of compared to a lot of the other antibiotics. But rifaximin, like I said, is super expensive. So you insurance has to pay for it. And I just recently had a patient that they were at the VA and the VA refused to pay. They had done two rounds and they had refused to pay to do it anymore. And they were struggling. I mean, no joke. He was having 15 to 20 diarrhea stools a day. So that's a problem. And it was impacting his quality of life, impacting his ability to function normally. It was just not working. So they had refused. So, you know, I did take him through the antimicrobial herbs and what you take and what you do to get rid of this on your own. So if that's you and you need somebody to help with that, feel free to go on our website and do one of my counseling sessions, or you'd have to do a package for sure, because we wouldn't be able to get through it in one visit. You'd have to do a package, and I can help kind of guide you on what you do with the antimicrobial herbs and how much and what to take and which ones to buy and all that. But it's things that you can buy on Amazon, things that you can get online, not at a local health food store. You're not going to find these there, but you can get them online, and that would be a way to treat that as an alternative if rifaximin is not available or not an option. So keep that in mind. But usually when you do it, you're doing these herbs and you want all this bacteria to kind of come out and play. You want them out there. So what do? You have to eat a higher carbohydrate diet. And I will tell you, you may not feel fabulous because you're really feeding those bacteria, not necessarily feeding them, but you're kind of providing all the stuff to get them to come out. So they're fuel sources, and then the antimicrobials or the antibiotic comes out and kills them. So think of it as you're trying to get them to come out in the street as the traffic into the traffic to get killed. That's maybe a horrible analogy, I don't know. But it's at least visual enough you understand what I'm talking about. So you want all of those bacteria to be enticed with the carbs to come out and in the street, so that the rifaximin or the antimicrobial herbs will come out and run over them and kill them. So you do have to increase your carb intake during this cycle of taking these antimicrobials or antibiotics. So you have to get a little uncomfortable. Then typically we also do a fiber. It is a low FODMAP fiber, and that will also help bring out those bacteria so that they are getting out there to get killed. So, and I like to do a high FODMAP diet, and FODMAP is just FODMAP. You can Google it, high FODMAP, low FODMAP. So during the antibiotic and antimicrobials, we do high FODMAP foods because we want them to come out. And those are the ones that kind of make you feel real bloated and your belly distended, lots of gas. So all those symptoms we talked about, those are the things that you're going to have symptoms of. So you do as much as you can tolerate. And if you're miserable, you back down, but at least do some. And then after you do the treatment with your antimicrobials and the antibiotic on your high FODMAP diet and adding in the fibers and stuff. Then once you're done with that, then you go to a low FODMAP diet for a little while so that you are calming everything down and you're starting to feel really good because you've gotten rid of these bacteria and you've kind of killed them off. So hopefully that kind of makes sense on what you're doing, because SIBO is not always easy to get rid of. It is something that can come back. So you may require a few treatments of this. But there are things you can do. I normally put people, once you do the treatment, you're on the low FODMAP diet for, 2 to 4 weeks and you've already killed them off. So you might want to, I usually have you do some things like berberine or other supplements to kind of keep the, it's more of like an antimicrobial, antibacterial type of supplement that will actually keep you, those bacteria at bay, and do that for a few months to help keep them away and not allow that to start flourishing again. So there are so many strategies and everybody reacts differently, but if you are struggling with heartburn and you have tried many things and nothing seems to work and you're just not sure why you're struggling so much with heartburn, and this may be something to consider, talk to your doctor, talk to a healthcare practitioner, seek me out if you need help with the antimicrobial herbs and you really need somebody to guide you on what to take and what to do. I am your girl and will help you get over this issue for sure. But it's definitely something that I can't say is talked about as, maybe in the weight loss surgery community as much as it should be, because I just find it's very common. And it's just, there are some pretty big red flags I look for, even in the blood work. If I have certain people with their lab levels coming back low with nutrition, because unfortunately those, the SIBO, they will forage for the foods that before you even get access to it. So things like iron is, you're feeding all those bacteria, the iron, and you'll have low levels regardless of how much you're taking. And it's just never getting normal. And it could be because of the SIBO, because you are just fueling and feeding them and it's never getting into your cells. So those can be pretty big red flags for me to pay attention to with the blood work and then the symptoms and just all the things that are very, kind of put the whole puzzle piece together to let you know, hey, I think a treatment of SIBO treatment would make sense for you, and see if you can't get some improvement in your symptoms and start feeling better. Get your lab levels up. All that makes a huge difference. So I hope I've helped give you maybe something new to think about, something new to talk to your bariatric team about. If they look at you cross-eyed and say, I have no idea what SIBO is, seek me out. I'll be happy to help you and get you on your way to getting better and feeling fabulous again. So if you, like I said at the beginning, if you're new to us and haven't ever followed us, get in our gastric health club where we have these discussions and people ask questions and I share different content that's really important for you guys to understand with a different twist. I'm all about functional medicine and utilizing these strategies as solutions for the problems that kind of come up after weight loss surgery. So we look forward to talking to you in the gastric health club, and we will see you next time. Bye-bye.